is assuming sickness, and last few weeks have not been able to take the classes. And Rinpoche has advised that the classes should not be left blank, so people don't get disappointed. Therefore, the first Thursday I was able to take the class, and last Tuesday, unfortunately, due to certain reasons, I wasn't able to take. So Jim very kindly took over the class. Was good, because Rinpoche is very concerned to not let the classes go blank. Expression meaning not to just let it nothing happen, so at least there's some review and discussion as well, something happening to keep the continuity. Will have to excuse me. It's not good to apologize at the beginning all the time, but my voice is not that well at the moment. And with the classes, maybe before we go into the actual topic of the Tuesday evenings, it may be good to maybe briefly talk about how in Mahayana, and especially Tantric Buddhist perspective, when a teacher becomes sick, what is the perspective to be seen and held by the trainees, the disciples. This topic was already discussed the first Thursday after Rinpoche assumed sickness. Unfortunately, my talk on that topic wasn't recorded on the tape. We did try to record it, but afterward found it wasn't recorded. It was very interesting, a class at that time on the topic, because there came up a lot of questions from the people. And active, what's called clarification of many points about what happens when a teacher assumes sickness or a teacher is sick. I will briefly, just as it's important point, briefly say a point about it. The thing is, in Mahayana and especially tantric context, a lama or teacher is the Buddha. So it's an enlightened being who is beyond suffering, beyond impure thoughts, the causes of sufferings, and therefore beyond actual pain and suffering of sickness. This then would mean there will have to be dramatic difference in the way how people would have to view a teacher assuming sickness as what normally people would look at others. An ordinary person becomes sick. Of course, this whole point will boil down to the basic pieces, whether a lama, a teacher, is a Buddha or not, whether a teacher is an enlightened being or not. There's no time and not that necessary to go into that point. There are so many reasonings put forth in the, all the major Lamrim teachings and commentaries, how Lama is a Buddha, a teacher is a Buddha, but manifesting in the form of human, to guide us on par with our accessibility through karma and so forth. That whole point will boil down to that basic thesis, whether a lama actually is a Buddha or not. But let's assume that all those reasonings put forth in Lamrim teachings are correct and reliable, and no need to repeat over them. Then let's, on the assumption that lama is an enlightened being, a Buddha, then it is not that difficult to see that a lama's sickness is an act. in good sense, a display, a manifestation in good sense of the main reflection would be to give a lesson or some kind of instructions to the trainee, the disciples. But also there is a kind of a big difference if one sees a lama as an ordinary person subject to impure thought, the causes of sickness, the impure sufferings. And in that way, if one really thinks a lama is sick and must be suffering immensely, it cannot be denied that such a care is genuine, well-intentioned. But we can see that whole perspective would be based whether out of innocence, that whole perspective is based on the point lama is ordinary person and is not enlightened, has all the impure thoughts. If that would be the case, then there is no point to rely one's whole lot and future and everything upon such a person. One is contradicting oneself. But on practical level, as on that poster we touched, on practical level, should we then not attempt to give medication and look after the lama, even though it can be an act? Or should we let it just go like that? And why also from lama's side they themselves what's called make attempt to go to hospital and receive medication and so forth? It is a contradiction, and to put it beautifully, it is a paradox, and so much of it you can find in the Mahayana Buddhism and Tantric Buddhism. There's a lot of paradoxical things. But I would think that they all are justifiable, and they all have their rightful meaning and reasons behind. In the case of Lama deliberately taking medication, the lesson would be that even to get cured, even one may not be sick, but by having assumed sickness, there will have to be an illusory means by which that assumed sickness can be cured. So for an act, there will have to be another act to match with that. On that basis, and that would also indicate that there is no denial from the lama's side of cause and conditions in producing the results. So cause and effect relationship is maintained. We would say that would be the good way to look at such paradox in this case. Now, if one views lama as sick as one would normally to an other ordinary person, then the outcome that happens in one's behavior, gestures, language, so forth, would be totally inappropriate, although we don't need to bash or what people do with good intention, but it would be completely inappropriate and sort of, and other things. For example, people would say, "Oh yeah, I will pray for Rinpoche. I will pray that he recovers soon." And if it goes further, then it can be a bit humorous, where people might do deity practice and send white lights of purification for Lama, who may need purification. Or not, but I mean, there could be such an inappropriate, innocent things done based on such perspective. We can therefore say there's a huge difference in the two perspectives. But in the questions, there were talks about then should we go and offer flowers to the Lama or not. There can be such things, such questions, out of practical inconveniences and requirement one may need to ask. But the thing is, there's still nothing wrong based on the same concept. that Lama is the Buddha, one can still do the other things one would normally do in the case of an ordinary person being sick. So one may visit a Lama, offer flowers, and so forth. This all feasible. They all do all work. It seems like a not very good way to go into all the details. And the other reason is, one other important point related with that is, why then do Lama become sick? Why do they assume sickness? Why do they put on the act of sickness? Obviously, it is alleged and very strongly believed, even in the tradition, that when students are not in harmony and when they are not practicing well, then that would be reflected in the health of Lama, because after all, the very existence of Lama is completely and wholly for students and trainees' benefit. Not a moment is for her or his benefit from the Lama's side. Not a moment. On this basic premises that Lama is an enlightened being, there's no need to look after one's fulfillment. It's already fulfilled. So the reason why Lama becomes sick, of course, that is given in the tradition, but Buddha's students and members don't have to feel guilty and negative about it. And also from my side, as to talk about it would be inappropriate, as I did say this point on the Thursday, first Thursday, because we can see, on the other hand, Buddha's members and students had the wonderful, incomparable karma and merits to be able to host and receive teaching from one of the rarest being you could find in this part of the universes, such a teacher who, even when, as more people would know, who at this moment has great requirement by his many students, intensive practicing and studying once over in India and in his native homeland in Tibet. People here don't have to feel negative about that. The other reason a Lama would assume sickness as well, eventually even assume death, dying, would be to very strongly teach with great emphasis the need to terminate grasping that things would last permanently. What scripturally is called truth grasping, or permanent grasping, sorry, what scripturally is called permanence grasping, that things would permanently be there. Like, as you know, there are four major misconceptions: seeing impermanent as permanent, unclean as clean, not empty as empty, or emptiness as not empty, and without self as being with self or identity. So those are the four misconceptions. So especially in measure against permanent grasping, that Lama would assume even death dying away. And this, as you know, there is reflection in the long life prayers which are composed afterward, that the Lama please return soon, that in those prayers, whoever composes the prayer, which has to be another High Lama, say a Dalai Lama or someone else, it is quite common that the prayer would contain the lines such as, in order to pacify or in order to eliminate the permanent grasping of the trainees, the disciple, you have now entered into Dhammakaya sphere, Dhammakaya realm. But please, with your great compassion for the sake of destitute sentient beings, please return soon. So there would be such lines and theme in that direction in the prayers. So those two would be like a main reasons a lama would assume sickness. At any rate, like whether a lama is alive or assuming sickness or passing away, the emphasis is to sentient beings. Our emphasis is to benefit sentient beings by guiding them on the correct path by any way of teaching. Okay, so we'll stop at that point on that one. Is it all right? Now, with the Tuesday evenings, Rinpoche's teachings has been on the ninth chapter by Shantideva's work, popularly called in English, The Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And that chapter mainly deals with wisdom, but it is very interesting chapter, or for that matter, a writing of teachings about wisdom and realization of emptiness, overcoming of ignorance, the cause of all our problems and suffering, by presenting multitudes of counter-responses by other opinions during those classical times. Therefore it contains a lot of viewpoints by other Buddhist tenets against the highest Buddhist tenet, of which Shantideva explains the wisdom and the emptiness part. In any teaching, it is possible sometimes, although it may be very in appearance and format, technical looking, very textual session, but all sorts of people could attend this session, complete beginner, not very familiar with the concepts, and other premises based on which the present talk is being given. There would be people who have heard the topics of this session so many times. It's therefore difficult to cater for different types of people. In the Buddhist perspective, that's why there is a saying, only an enlightened being or one who has attained level of foreknowledge, a term meaning clairvoyance of reading others' mind, can very suitably cater for sentient beings' needs. Otherwise, it would be like talking without any awareness and understanding about the need and to whom to cater for. And also, because of that, there's a saying, Buddha's teaching never is unsuitable to anyone. An enlightened being's teaching is never unsuitable to anyone. The reason for that is the enlightened being who has power, capability of mind to read others' mind, their disposition, their likes and need, would give teaching suitable to that, no matter how many mixed types of listeners there would be. But then, of course, there's a mention of Buddhas may speak in one language and it could be heard by listeners of hundreds of different languages. The point for this is, therefore, during the teachings, it's of course very difficult from part of translator to not sound intelligible in good sense, so not to make it unknown to all, to certain people. If there is an interpretation of the translation, then it is already an extra bit in the actual delivery of the teaching, and people could get bored and so forth. Therefore, it is possible that people who have been coming during Tuesday evening, some may feel that the teachings are a bit unrelatable, unplaceable, and so forth. From Rinpoche's side and also from my side as a translator, we try our best how to cater for all with our limited resources. Now, linked with that reason and linked with that point is, while coming here, I was thinking, how should I manage the session tonight? If there turn out to be different types of levels of people, then it may not be suitable to do a review of what has been gone so far in the explanation by Rinpoche, because that might sound a bit too textual and unrelatable. In which case, I thought it would be better to start with some general important points about wisdom and about emptiness. And then if there is a time, we perhaps can go through the prepared outline, which covers at one glance what has been covered in the Tuesday evening so far. At this point, people want to maybe ask questions or something. Are you happy to continue? Now, with let's hope we'll realize emptiness tonight. Now, as a translator, I have done emptiness talk translation many times, and with all due respect, of course, it will come down to point saying it is empty because it's not inherently existing. It is emptiness, so it's empty. It is void because it lacks true existence. It lacks existence from its own side, whatever the topic or the example of the context be. So, on a language level, it is easy to say emptiness means emptiness or lack of inherent existence. Emptiness means lack of natural formation, lack of actual formation, actual existence. So, before that, it's maybe interesting to find that in the original languages, they use synonyms for existence. So, existence is synonyms with formed, and existence is synonymous with is there, or existence in the sense of not as a being abiding or surviving, but also present, absent. An object of knowledge, but formed and existing. So they're used as the same interchangeable word in the scriptures. So it is not that difficult in the translation, and as well in papers, whoever have listened to emptiness teachings, it is emptiness. The book is emptiness. Its nature is emptiness because it doesn't truly exist. It doesn't inherently exist. It is not formed truly there. It does not exist from its own side. So all those. Now, it becomes like a sort of a easily flowing, with no hair-raising inquisitiveness raised from the listener's side. And negative thing about it, it would become like more like jargon, something repeated over and over. Now that negative part comes about to not question what actually those words and terms, I mean terms and words, are. To look at good way, they are medium of concepts, important concepts. So it comes about due to not asking the question what those means. What inherently means, existing means, and so forth. Definitely, these talks will not be a meditator's talk of emptiness, but I would not make it a linguist talk on emptiness. So between the two, we'll say something, a balance of two. Yeah. If it's a meditator's talk on emptiness, it would be out of realization. But we never should not deny the need of the medium in which that realization is expressed. Otherwise, in the first place, the enlightened beings would not use the speech and the medium of language and science and so forth. Okay, that's one thing to look at. We'll come after. Now, the other thing is similar. Other thing about emptiness is, yes, I can relate. The book doesn't exist truly. The book doesn't exist inherently. But what happens then? It doesn't. Nothing happens to my perspective. My whole perspective doesn't change. It doesn't seem to lessen my ego grasping. It doesn't seem to uproot the causes of my samsara, my existence of cycle. Yes, yeah. The person, the door, so forth, is not truly there. Yes, I've heard about it many times, reasoning. It is interdependent, it is dependent arising. It's not truly there. Now, that's another thing. But it appears, and I can ask, relate, yet it appears. And it's not there. Now, the feeling one has is, with such thing is, what then, the thing about these two, they're related, will go, inherently existing and so forth, we'll discuss later. But let's say, the thing about that is, the question would be asked, then how come, or when would it be possible that one realizes, one understands it's not truly there, but with that understanding, a change in one's grasping, a change in one's view would take place. Okay, so it's not that well put, but we'll look at it a different way as well. Now, the thing is, to an ordinary person, when analyzing non-inherent existence or not naturally formed existence, not naturally formed way of things, it is relatable through reasoning, or to put it derogatively, intellectually, conceptually, that it is not truly there. It is not inherently there. Now, one can relate that, but still, it's supposed to. But still, it's there's still a grasping. There's still a kind of a course of all impure thoughts. What's called ego grasping. Now, this anyway, that's the point. If it's not made that clear, now we can relate this point. Why that happens? That we can relate intellectually, that we can relate theoretically, but nothing happens in the state of our consciousness. Nothing happens in the way our transformation of mind is supposed to happen in realizing the wisdom, in realizing selflessness, or in realizing emptiness. Now, that would not happen. So that's the question, that's the poor problem, and it's the thing to look at. Now, as a response, that would not happen to an ordinary person, that nothing, no transformation will happen. One will still go on with ego grasping, one will still go on with ignorance. Although, when one reasons that it is not truly there, it is not inherently there, that one can relate. But the moment that stops, that doesn't, the grasping is still there, the ignorance is still there. So that happens. Now the reason for that would be, from one point, maybe a bit negative and depressing. But to see the bitter truth is, in the highest Buddhist tenets perspective, the Prasangika Madhyamika, the Trust Reasoner, in their perspective, an ordinary person's consciousness is necessarily mistaken consciousness. Or to put it paraphrase, a person who has not yet realized emptiness, that person's mind or consciousness all the time is distorted, all the time is mistaken, because there is ignorance. So it's not surprising when joined with this present problem that we can theoretically, but still nothing happens. The grasping is still there. These are, I think, extremely important point, because this the answer for that would dispel a lot of commonly thought of misunderstandings about emptiness and realization and so forth. Is it all right to go like that? Yeah. Now, on the other hand, let's look. Oh, okay, because I already mentioned about the depressing part. So, better to put something else to uplift as against that. Well, that means I am an ordinary person who has not yet realized emptiness. How depressing. Everything about my mind is mistaken. Now, in the highest Buddhist tenets understanding, it is true, and factually it is relatable to be true. But good thing about the whole explanation about emptiness, in this case about ignorance and mistaken, distorted consciousness of ordinary being, good thing that comes in the explanation and teachings about it is there will be end to such state if the methods are applied, if the antidotes are applied, if one does the necessary practices and meditation. So it's uplifting. Well, I'm an ordinary person, but I can become Buddha, I can become enlightened, given the practices and meditation so far done. So it is not depressing to counter with that. That's the point. Now let's look at the other point. As ordinary person, if it is acceptable, since beginningless time, of course this is based on the basic theory, there is no beginning, or there was no beginning to our mind. It has been coming from beginningless time. And from beginningless time, it has been associated with ignorance, the lack of wisdom, realizing emptiness from beginningless time. And along with that, from beginningless time, from our beginningless rebirths and rebirths, our mind has been flowing with all impure thoughts, attachment, hatred, jealousy, so forth. We have therefore all these layers of wrappings on our mind, consciousness. Would it then be possible that with mere momentary rationalization and applying theoretically even the correct reasoning to prove emptiness, then there would be change with such a thick-layered mind with ignorance and so forth? So that would what's called cover that thing. Now, otherwise, there should happen change the moment we apply reasonings that the book is not there, that I'm not truly existent, the strong grasping is not there, it's merely labeled and so forth. There isn't any change and transformation. So the reason is we've been very much associated with the negative, the counterpart of that. And merely with that slight force, the whole forces of the other cannot be challenged. So that's one thing. Now, in this way, then what the instructions then say is, one first has to theoretically establish the lack of concrete identity, lack of true existence, lack of inherent existence, so forth, about oneself as a person, the ego identity, and about all external phenomena or things. And then one gets completely cleared of all doubts and misunderstanding, then remains single-pointed in what is called equipoise, the profound meditation session, remains single-pointed with the power of calm abiding, which is single-pointed, mastery of single-pointed power to remain concentrated as long as one wishes. So once theoretically it is understood, then on that ascertained understanding, decisive understanding, remain single-pointed in formal meditation session, and remain single-pointedly focused on such understanding of emptiness, lack of true existence, lack of inherent existence. Not one meditative session, not one equipoise, but many repeated sessions of profound meditation. And then if it improves, then one would gain what is called the realization of space-like emptiness during equipoise, during profound meditation. And then when coming out of that meditation session, by the force of having ascertained emptiness through single-pointed focus during the session, that out of session, things would appear, but there will be no grasping, there will be no clinging. Only then it happens that there will be no clinging. Only then, if one does theorize or rationalize about non-inherent existence, there will, along by, be no clinging and grasping to the things of oneself. And that becomes what scripturally called the illusion-like emptiness. So those two, the space-like emptiness during equipoise or profound meditation time, and illusion-like emptiness during post-session times or during in-between sessions. If it does sound heavy, sorry about that. But this is interesting, because then there will be no need to ask that emptiness can be beyond concept and it will just come one day. You don't have to work for it. I mean, will it be reasonable to think that? I mean, that would be automatically countered. Such comes would be automatically countered. So there will be no, there will be no realization without working for it, because it is very commonly misunderstood thing. People when they come to see lamas in the private interviews and so forth, that without having done any what's called necessary minimum requirements, that people seem to think that they have realized emptiness, or they have sparks of realization of emptiness. And similarly, that emptiness realization might just happen if you just remain every day calm for a few minutes, and it might just happen like that. Anyway, see, my main focus in planning the session was to talk briefly about important points without making it sound too heavy and negative and bashing, sort of thing. It then becomes like a relatable, that it is meaningful to familiarize, because meditation, as would be explained, is familiarization, getting used to virtuous state of understanding and knowledge as counter to non-virtuous and mistaken, and then retain it, maintain it over and over, where the force of familiarized knowledge and ascertainment becomes stronger, able to surpass the mistaken one, and then realization and so forth would come about. And now another point about is why in emptiness, why one rely on a brief instruction by an experienced teacher and be contained with that, and what the hassle and a mess about going through all the reasonings and rationalizations and this, that, and that, that, so forth. So people could ask that. I would say the thing is, the topic itself is so delicate, there's bound to be so many avenues of doubts, discomfort, lack of decision, so forth. Now, they all will be cleared if one counters all those doubts and the questions come so forth based on such, misunderstanding. And then those doubts so forth would be cleared. And the time one goes into the actual meditation and instruction, applying the instruction, there is no danger of mind still suspecting, still doubting, whether it is truly existent or not, whether it is emptiness or not, so forth. I would say that would be the main need, why there will have to be thorough rationalization and very rigorous, over and over, applying of... See, in the scriptures, they talk about hundreds of reasonings, especially in the case of Bodhisattva Mahayana, realizing emptiness, in different to the lower... the hearers and solitary realizers, Mahayana, Bodhisattva, applies hundreds of reasonings. So hundreds, as the word used, could mean infinite, as many as possible, to every angle and view to establish emptiness, in order to overcome all sorts of possible doubts that one may have still lingering about the topic. It may definitely seem as nine chapter, just by outline, it looks very like a court case sort of thing. Let me please go through some other important points, because this will help in future when Rinpoche gives teachings, because I mainly will be dealing with some commonly raised doubts and issues about emptiness and wisdom, and few which has to do more with the language or the medium by which the important concepts are explained. Now we go back to inherent existence. Well, as we mentioned earlier, it's very relatable, and we even don't sometimes seem to question what does lack of inherent existence means. What does lack of, even simple, it doesn't exist truly, because it's dependent arising, so forth. Yeah, there doesn't seem to be. We've been so much like not even question about it. It doesn't even trigger a little bit. Inherent existence, whatever its English meaning and so forth be, is opposed to emptiness. Something exists inherently is opposed to something being of emptiness or lacking such nature. Uh, good thing explained about inherent existence is that if something is inherently existing, the actual word, actually, it's popularly translated as inherent existence, but actual word in the original Tibetan and Sanskrit would rather mean like naturally formed. But then word natural, again, can be interpretable to whatever individual connotation. Even in the English-speaking case, you individually people differ from. Like with anything, with translation, is very tricky thing. Because every word has got not only cultural connotation, but individually, these mean different things. How can you scatter for such a diverse interpretation, even on individual level? It's difficult. But still, let's assuming there is a commonly unwritten acceptance about the word's general meaning, then originally the words for inherent existence actually says naturally formed. So whatever that would, but generally naturally formed, whatever it would mean, that's how it means. Later on, some bright translators in the 60s and 70s, especially Jeffrey Hopkins, those people might have felt it better to use the word inherent to mean it more, although inherent is just being there. As you go look into its literal meaning and etymological in dictionary, doesn't really convey the original meaning. No matter whatever be those differences, let's look at inherent existence. Now, in the like Tsongkhapa's writing on praise to Buddha for having taught interdependent arising, there the line says, Rangshin Chumin, if something is naturally formed, if something is inherently existing, then it is unalterable. And if something is dependent arising, it is alterable, it is changeable. So from that, we get a very good description. No matter whatever inherent existence so forth may have different meaning, even in English-speaking world, but the definition we then would find is, if something is inherently existing, it is unchangeable, it is unalterable. So that would mean, as then the whole teachings become so relevant, because they do talk about, say, if the book is inherently existing as a book, then it will always be book. It will never change, no matter elemental and natural disaster so forth. It will subject to no change at all, unalterable. But that is inherently there, naturally formed as that. So that's a very good description. And then we can relate when there is a teaching and so forth. It is emptiness because it is not inherently existing. So it is not existing unalterably. It is not existing unchangeably. It is subject to change and so forth. That sounds good. It makes a huge difference about those points. And now let's say word emptiness itself again. Unfortunately, I didn't get chance to look at old English translations of Buddhist texts on emptiness and wisdom recently. Otherwise, it would be interesting to look what in the past people would have used the word for to translate the word shunyata and tongpanyi into. Voidness. Who is that?
Voidness.
By whom? Edward Combs.
And the guy who did the Zen translation.
Ambrose. That's good. Popularly followed, both wideness and emptiness. But apart from that, because it gives a good it gives a good avenue to dispel a lot of misunderstanding about emptiness itself, even by using the right term and medium to express it. Like emptiness, well, does the ness part, any double S part, convey to English speaking people just mere? Does it convey? It doesn't. It doesn't convey that part. Therefore, in the original word, shunyata tongpani has more like tongpa, empty, and ni is only, or merely, or just. So just empty. Merely empty. Merely. Now, that itself would seem more like a language play or word play, but the implication behind that is, in the explanation about emptiness, they did go in the past when there was a lot of misunderstanding about it in the classical period, even in Tibet in 13th, 14th century during Tsongkhapa's time, that masters like Tsongkhapa did write detailedly about how emptiness is not an affirming phenomena, but it is non-affirming, it is negative phenomena. That's a scriptural language. What that means is, because a lot of people still think emptiness is nature of everything, that everything is in the nature of emptiness, but they still underlyingly beneath their mind, they still seem to think emptiness must be something solidly to really go for it. Well, it must be there. So that's a mistake. Even like in the Liberation in the Palm of Hand, Pabongka Rinpoche on that point mentions, while during the meditative, during session, meditation, emptiness, if one thinks one has found emptiness, then that's wrong. If one thinks I've realized emptiness, then it indicates it's imperfect. So it's not to be found. Emptiness itself is emptiness. That's why in the divisions of emptiness they talk about 4 emptinesses, 16 emptinesses, 20 emptinesses, and in those lists we do find the list emptiness, emptiness. As such as say external emptiness, internal emptiness, emptiness, emptiness. Emptiness itself is emptiness. That's a meaning. So scripturally put, therefore emptiness is called as a negative phenomena, non-affirming phenomena. For example, the fat cat eats, the fat cat doesn't eat during daytime, then it is negative, but it is not non-affirming, it is affirming. What it affirms is, implicitly it affirms a statement that the cat must be eating during night time. Because the cat is fat. The fat cat doesn't eat during daytime. So that's it. What's called classical example given. Although in the text they use the name of a classical character during Buddha's time. A person. That's affirming. But if we say booklessness, then it doesn't affirm or say anything apart from that. So that's a negative phenomena. So anything, a statement which doesn't say anything or doesn't imply anything at all is then scripturally called the negative phenomena, non-affirming phenomena. And emptiness is explained as a negative phenomena, non-affirming phenomena. But that is that's a very brief way of describing things. Very good. See, think about the technical words and things in any field of knowledge and work is to save verbosity, wordiness. So in the past, the great seers have used short, compact words. So they use non-affirming phenomena or negative phenomena. The reason, the meaning behind is that if something is emptiness, that still doesn't say it doesn't mean to imply there's something beyond that. That's the mere absence, and it's supposed the just empty, the just part, or the merely empty is supposed to indicate that part. Some mere shunya part, just the ni part, the mere. And abroad. So, being very literal, in 89, for Rinpoche's 9 preliminaries are used in their foreword emptiness, just empty, just empty, just empty. So it's very awkward, but it has its own meaning. So, and sometimes it is good to use alternate word to trigger some kind of thinking. But Elaine and some other people have suggested maybe just empty may be a bit awkward, so merely would be better. So merely empty. Merely empty. So instead of emptiness, merely empty. That's good. And so voidness, but that still has that called awkwardness. So mere void. Mere, or just void. Anyway, that's an opinion. You can consider and look at it, how it is. So emptiness is explained to be emptiness. It's not solidly to be found. The things about this is they dispel a great deal of popular questions which then need not be asked. No question sessions. Yeah, there are some other important points, but I think we'll limit to this, and then we'll anyway have some questions. And after the questions, if we have any time, then we'll briefly go through the review of Rinpoche's teaching so far, based on outline. And it was suggested, somebody suggested it would be good to have debate with some one group of section holding a thesis and the other asking questions. Perhaps we can do that on the outline later, if there's time. Okay, then we'll have some questions anyway. Well, in the teachings, the instruction, that's the spark is the way of people's description, but it scripturally would mean direct realization. That only happens when one has, when that happens, then one is on part of seeing, which means one already has done part of accumulation and part of preparation. During those two parts, already it's explained, there has to be a great deal of many sessions and meditation theoretically on emptiness through conceptual understanding. So we would it would mean, as I said, it's people's claim, sparks happening. So it would be more likely such thing doesn't happen. Yeah. So, if the realization or any experience of realizing emptiness happened, it would happen after a great deal of theoretical and conceptual sound understanding of emptiness, along with a great deal of accumulation of merits and purification, and when direct realization happens, it would not just be a spark, it would have continuity. Well, it's people's claim, to put it nicely, but in other, it's just a, people claim also, what's called private interview translators, throughout, people come with all sorts of claims, and you cannot, deny it, yes?
Mind is in some form of clear art, for example, then wouldn't there be